Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Indie Rock's biggest band returns. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Today, we debate indie megaband Arcade Fire. And later, live music from the New York-based jazz ensemble, The Respect Sextet. True to their name, Arcade Fire are a hot commodity. The seven-member Canadian indie rock band recently hit number one with their third album, The Suburbs. And earlier this month, they played two sold-out nights at New York's own massive Madison Square Garden. But their dramatic style isn't for everyone. This is a rock band that takes itself very, very seriously. So when it comes to Arcade Fire, are you a disciple or a dissenter? It's this week's
Soundcheck Smackdown!
And we're joined in the studio today by Time Out New York music writer Sophie Harris, who calls the new Arcade Fire album soaring, blissful, and worthy of the hype. And on the line from Washington, D.C. is Chris Richards, the pop music critic for The Washington Post, who claims the album is full of joyless grandiosity, air-sucking humorlessness, and soggy sentimentality. To both of you, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thanks, glad to be here.
Sophie, let me start with you. You said the album is worthy of the hype. What could possibly warrant the amount of hype that came with this record?
I mean, certainly there's a good deal of hysteria that came along with this record, isn't there? And that's the same amount of hysteria that's greeted the second album and the first one. You know, and people love to get excited about Arcade Fire, and I think even now they're slightly bemused by it still.
They being Arcade Fire.
They being the band, yeah. But I think this is an ambitious record, and I think it's a beautiful record, and I think it's a rather strange record, which wins my admiration every time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'll certainly go with strange. What about you, Chris? Do you find anything strange about this record?
I don't find it strange. I find it incredibly boring. It's so full of grand gestures, and everything that hits my eardrums feels so bloated and joyless. It becomes really fatiguing for me to listen to this record from top to bottom. And much of that has to do with the fact that I think they don't really have a sense of humor.
Well, now you've called the record joyless and humorless. So if it's lacking joy and humor, what are you hearing in its place?
I think it's just high melodrama from start to finish. And the humorlessness, I don't need them to be, you know, kooky jokesters or anything like that. But I think that, and I'm a firm believer that all great rock bands always remember to kind of throw in a little wink to their fans to remind you that they're human. You know, you think of someone like a band like Black Flag, which is one of the most mm-hmm. compelling, self-righteous rock bands of all time. They still wrote TV Party. You know, they still covered Louie Louie.
Right.
Arcade Fire are never really winking. They're never really sharing an inside joke with you. And it's all just high melodrama. And for a lot of people, that's very engrossing. But to me, it just makes them very inaccessible.
There's a moment in the first song, the title track, The Suburbs, where the singer, Wynn Butler, is asking for a daughter. You know, this is why I want a daughter before everything falls apart. But if that's too much, then send me a son. It's sung very seriously, but if you look at it on paper, it almost sounds like a punchline or reads like the punchline to a joke. So do you think there's humor there?
Absolutely. I think there's a wink and a nod there. And in fact, I remember talking to Wynn Butler around the time of the second album. And this is in regard to them being a funny band. They are a fun band to be around. But B, Wynn was talking about having found out that a lot of the big major labels had invented word of mouth departments to kind of keep up with the kids and be in the know. And he laughed and said, I mean, it's just the most perfectly depressing thing I've ever heard. We might call our next record word of mouth department. You know, and it's bleak humor and gallows humor sometimes. But I think that kind of knowingness is there, that it's just not, you know, a laugh a minute.
Chris, you sounded like you needed to jump in for a moment.
No, I guess that never comes across to me. In a lot of ways, they just seem like the next link in the humorless U2 Coldplay chain, you know, and I'm of the mind that one U2 is definitely enough and one Coldplay might be one too many. I mean, I want something a little more human from them that doesn't come across in the music, it doesn't come across in the live show, it doesn't come across on the records to me.
The record is called The Suburbs. It's the third from Arcade Fire. It's their first number one. And here's the song ready to start.
Just begin again. You
Ready to Start is the song from Arcade Fire. They actually played this live on The Daily Show, which is not a venue for a whole lot of live music, but Jon Stewart and the gang certainly made room for this band a couple of days ago. They have the number one album for at least another day or two until Eminem, it seems, will displace them again. Two sold-out nights at Madison Square Garden. Critical darlings, except for Chris Richards. Sophie, why is this band such a big deal?
Why is it such a big deal? I think partly because they are such a compelling proposition live. And I remember the first time I saw them years and years ago in a tiny, tiny little venue, overhearing someone saying, what's amazing about them is that they play like they're not about to go on tour and they don't have to conserve their voices. You know, they're shouting their lungs out. And I think what's amazing about them is that they've maintained that level of energy over the years. You know, they really play their hearts out every time they play a show. I think, you know, kind of for literary references, it's a treasure trove and that you can kind of uncover so much from each of the records. I think they make very layered, interesting records. You know, there's a Bulgarian choir on one record and, you know, the kitchen sink on the next record. And there's a lot to find.
I'll ask Chris Richards the same question. Why is this band such a big deal, Chris?
I think we're desperately, desperately seeking rock and roll heroes at this point. You know, there's been endless talk about the idea of the digital era kind of fracturing our tastes into all these little niches. And I think people are still pining for, you know, a band to really get behind and support, you know, and deify in a lot of ways. And I think that this band follows so closely in the U2 mold, who have kept that kind of torch going throughout the decades. They seem to hit a lot of the same notes that U2 hits. And I think people are really eager to kind of get behind that and feel that sort of communion together at their shows. And it makes me feel like a very, very lonely man in this world. But it's puzzling to me. I mean, I've really invested, I listened to this record a gazillion times trying to figure out what makes it tick, and it just washes right over me every time. It's like watching a James Cameron film or something where it's very impressive when it's happening, and then 3 hours later you're like, oh, I feel really manipulated and kind of violated.
You're hungry again is what you're saying.
Exactly, exactly.
3 hours later you're hungry again.
Yeah, and I don't remember a lot of the melodies either. That first melody that you guys played when the show started from the suburbs, mm-hmm. That's the only melody I remembered about 48 hours after listening to the record, like, you know, 10 times in a row. So,
all right, well,
strange.
Let's see what we can do about Chris feeling lonely. Soundcheck listeners, are you an Arcade Fire disciple or a dissenter? What do you think of the new album? You can call us at 212-433-WNYC or leave a comment at wnyc.org/soundcheck. Again, the number 212-433-WNYC. That's 433-9692. As always, producer Joel Meyer is in the control room and has some of the comments that have already come in. Is Chris going to be feeling a little less lonely after you read some of these?
I don't know. Only time will tell, John. But here's what the early birds have to say. Rory from Sudbury in the UK is a disciple. Rory really, really likes this record and leaves this cinematic comment. I imagined 14 suburban houses filmed in one unbroken take, the camera taking us into each house, into the lives of unremarkable, everyday people and families. Whew. Okay, now, Jay, our listener, is not a fan of the album. Jay writes, where does that leave Wynn and Will Butler, who grew up in the suburbs and obviously think that they themselves are quite remarkable? I think that superior attitude is all over this record, and I don't quite know how people can stand it.
So a couple of very different views, early views, but there are calls coming in, and we'll get to those in a moment. But, Sophie, is there anything new to be gleaned from this third Arcade Fire record?
Yeah, I think there is. I mean, I think one of the things that's always been interesting about this band is that they're a band who make records that aren't about romantic love. And that's an extraordinary extraordinary thing in this day and age, and certainly not something that U2 or Coldplay have really brought their attention to. You know, you have Grief on the first record. The second record is, ah, the world is falling apart. You know, and this third record is this kind of existential ennui, you know, along the lines of Terry Gilliam's Brazil. Terry Gilliam, obviously, who filmed the Madison Square Garden mm-hmm. concert, which was a beautiful pairing for my money. But this is a most unusual thing to do, and particularly when you consider even the stage setup at Madison Square Garden, where you had this enormous concrete overpass, you know, and some football stadium lights, and it was kind of bleak and muted and somber. And you compare that to, say, U2 hauling a massive spider on stage, or Coldplay, who are still dressing up as Arcade Fire in their kind of military regalia. I think that's really funny.
Chris?
Yeah, I disagree. I think, you know, lyrically, the content to me is really tired territory. I mean, in America, we've had, in American culture, all the way from John Cheever through Todd Solondz's films, we've had, you know, this idea of the suburbs as a place of quiet menace. And I really want to see this band grow up and talk about adulthood. You know, we've had three records of kind of navel-gazing back into childhood, and this... the themes on this Suburbs album are just so monolithic and monochromatic.
But
if I might
just cut in for a second there,
sure.
I think that this record is
entirely...
It's a
smackdown. We expect you to cut in.
I'm going to smack it down. It may not be a British thing to do, but I'm going to have a go. I think it's entirely about addressing adulthood and growing up. And part of this record was inspired by, you know, Wynn being sent a postcard from one of his best friends with a picture of him and his daughter and growing up. And it's like, oh, and this is a very modern issue. You know, the fact that we have all these 20-somethings, 30-somethings who've been living these glamorous, you know, perhaps media jobs and whatnot, and thinking, oh, are we going to settle down then? Are we going to have kids? Is that what we want? You know, this
right.
is a thoroughly modern dilemma, and not something that I feel has been explored a lot through music. I do know what you mean about the films, but not so much in music.
Right. I, your review in Time Out was interesting. I really thought you made a good point about talking about feeling that tension between adulthood and looking back to your childhood. But to me, it's like this band is supposed to be leading the way for us, and I really have the need for them to look forward, to push forward, and take us into unfamiliar territory. So much of this is nostalgic, and I feel like a group that really has this kind of acclaim should be, you know, pushing the conversation forward and taking us somewhere we haven't been before, rather than kind of taking us back in a trip through time to, you know, our crummy youths in American suburbia, you know, which we've all had here, obviously, in this conversation. Sorry.
Or Canadian suburbia, as is the
right.
case with several of most of the members of the band Arcade Fire, except for Wynn and Will Butler. Chris Richards from the Washington Post is on the line. Sophie Harris from Time Out New York is with me in the studio. Calls coming in. Tatum is joining us from Williamsburg. Tatum, are you pro or con for the Arcade Fire?
Well, besides the fact that I'm from Williamsburg, I don't want that to be a contention point, but I do...
I think we seem to have lost Tatum, so while we try and
hearing the argument...
Oh, there he is. You're going to have to start again, Tatum, because we lost you for a moment there.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was just saying, you know, the new iPhone 4. I apologize.
Being product placement and a comment all at once. Well done.
being from Williamsburg, I don't want that to sort of make my perspective more jaded than it is. But I followed the Arcade Fire for a while now, and I really feel like they more or less have changed modern music. And I was listening to the argument earlier and talking about them emulating Coldplay and U2. It's really the other way around. I mean, I remember after Funeral came out, you had Coldplay and U2 clouding how wonderful this band was and how they were changing them in a new direction. And I'm not a fan of U2 or Coldplay, but I am a fan of David Bowie and David Byrne, both of which have played with the Arcade Fire upon their own particular request. So I feel like you've got two huge major rock stars, David Bowie and David Byrne, who mm-hmm. love the Arcade Fire. Why say, you know, oh, U2, Coldplay sucks, and therefore the Arcade Fire sucks? That's my point.
All right, Tatum, thanks. A counterpoint now from Nico in Manhattan. Hi, Nico.
Hi, how are you?
Okay. So,
yeah,
not a fan?
I got this thing because it was recommended by a couple of guys that I do respect. They're musicians as well, and I'm sort of a musician. But I collect popular music now. Well, it's not popular, but as I said, I found like, oh, a dozen bands, you know, like way better than this band. This is a pedestrian band. It doesn't... There's no distinguishing feature. It doesn't grab you in any way. I mean, I would imagine, even when I read, you know, these lyrics which are hand printed on the liner notes,
mm-hmm.
it's just drivel. I mean, it's endless drivel. And I do agree with the woman, the English woman, who has said that, you know, that people are hungry for some, you know, band that they can, you know, like worship or something like that. And I believe, I will tell you right now, that the probably the single most distinguishing feature about the band is their name. They've got a pretty decent name.
Well, if you've ever seen them live, it's they're pretty distinctive live, too. There's like a tribe of them out on stage there. It takes a village, as they say. Arcade Fire, you know, record number one was Funeral, 2004. Rolling Stone called it the album of the decade. Here's a little bit of that, and then switching over to Rococo from the new album by Arcade Fire. Arcade Fire, the number one album with The Suburbs. It includes this song, Rococo. We heard a little bit of Neighborhood Number 2 from the first Arcade Fire record back in 04, that album called Funeral. And we want to know what you think of Arcade Fire and the new record. Number one album for at least another day until the next set of rankings come out. You can call us at 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC, or comment online, wnyc.org/soundcheck. In a moment, more calls, comments, and our debate on Arcade Fire. And coming up later, live music from the New York jazz ensemble known as the Respect Sextet. No one ever accused them of being humorless. You'll find out why when they join us later on Soundcheck.
Check out today's Soundcheck blog.
Some people don't like the way Arcade Fire got to number one by cutting this deal with Amazon that allowed people to buy the album for $3.99. But wait, I thought we were supposed to be complaining that people weren't buying music. Are we now going to start complaining that they're not paying enough?
For the rest of the story, visit the Soundcheck page at WNYC.org.
Soundcheck, I'm John Schaefer. This album by Arcade Fire topped countless year-end lists after it was released in 2007. The album was called Neon Bible. Now the Canadian Septet are set to do the same thing this year with their new album, The Suburbs, but their flair for drama still rubs some people the wrong way. And with us to debate the band and the album once again are Sophie Harris, music writer for Time Out New York, and Chris Richards, pop music critic for The Washington Post. Chris told us earlier that he felt like a really lonely guy not liking Arcade Fire. That was before the comments started coming in. Joel right. Meyer, our producer in the control room, I see smoke rising from the computer screen in there.
The internet is hot today, at least our little corner of it. John, you mentioned earlier that you caught Arcade Fire playing on The Daily Show. So did Ken from Little Neck, and here are his three reactions in this order. Number one, huh? Number two, why is this band twice as big as they need to be? Two drum sets, really? And number three, please make it stop. Now, John, to really do justice to all of the great comments that are coming in on the page, I've got to read them kind of quickly here. Minfred from Red Hook, Brooklyn writes, this band is a total hoax, which, as P.T. Barnum told us, is easiest to perpetrate on the largest groups of people possible. Jack from Hotlanta writes, had my fill of that Steely Dan vocal sound years ago. Josh writes, what about the fact that they're ripping off Echo and the Bunnymen? And Susie from Manhattan writes, this music all sounds like the music in a commercial that's designed to make you feel all cool and indie, even when you're not.
That's an interest. I mean, the idea that this sounds like music for a commercial. Sophie, their music, they don't license their music to commercials, do they?
Yeah, that's a really big deal with Arcade Fire, is that they absolutely steadfastly refuse to have their songs kind of corrupted in that way. There was a legal dispute some time ago when I believe the NFL tried to use Wake Up as you know, a kind of anthemic sports backing, and they put their foot down and said no. Although recently, after the Haitian disaster, they did license Wake Up to be used in the Super Bowl, I believe, and then they used all of the proceeds, you know, as part of the charity
relief
effort,
yeah.
Which I'm sure will in and of itself annoy the haters and say, oh, they're so worthy, I can't bear them. But I think it's rather a nice thing to do.
Chris, are you annoyed by that?
Oh, of course not. It's a wonderful thing. I mean, I think bands that get involved in activism are wonderful, and I think, you know, protecting their sound from commercials, I think, is a great thing. The other thing that's interesting, though, is there's a lot of bands that sound like Arcade Fire in commercials, and they're so easy to mimic, and this is another weakness that I find in their sound, in that it's easy to replicate, and there's a lot of groups out there kind of doing that thing and selling it out, and so when I do hear them, it does sound like stuff in a commercial, because there's a lot of people sort of cribbing from their style, and it sort of cheapens the whole thing to me.
But, you know,
so, can they be blamed for that? I don't know, but
That's part of I was going to say, you know, can you blame the original for the imitators? But then there are all these people writing and saying that they themselves, Arcade Fire, are imitating a huge array of very different sound. I mean, someone hears Steely Dan. Someone else hears Echo and the Bunnymen.
Sure.
Someone else hears U2.
I mean, I think the great thing to bear in mind often is, you know, whether or not the person objects to being imitated. And judging by David Byrne, who was singing along, standing on his feet, singing along, baying along to Wake Up at the end of the Madison Square Garden show, I would say, no, probably not that irritated. And similarly,
but Sophie, do you hear any Talking Heads in Arcade Fire and what they're doing? Because Talking Heads to me is a group that really expanded the vocabulary of what rock music could do, and they tried all these innovative things, mm-hmm. and I don't hear any of that in Arcade Fire. It seems so milquetoast to me.
Oh, that's interesting. I don't think that they sound like a rip-off band of Talking Heads, but I certainly think that they've got their own thing going on. And I think crucial to that is the whole Wynn and Regine, his wife, dynamic, you know. And you have him sometimes being a little vocally overwrought, and then her very sweet vocal. And I think she brings something rather old-fashioned and playful. And I think in terms of their whole obsession with childhood, you have on the one hand, he's like, you know, when children have a very serious expression, they're very serious and very focused on one thing. And she's like all of the playful elements of children. And I just think that comes together to form something really beautiful and unique. I haven't seen that.
Although you have to actually be watching them, you know, whether you get that off a disc, I don't know. But let's see what Lamar in Queens on the line has to say. Lamar, you've seen the band live?
Yeah, I have seen them live. I saw them in Oceaga in Montreal.
Mm-hmm. And what'd you think?
I like, in all honesty, I mean, I think the debate is really, really good. But I only started listening to Arcade Fire probably about a few months ago on a recommendation from a friend. I got a couple of the albums. My wife and I listened to them, and I was like, they're okay. And then I went to actually go see them live, and it totally changed my perception of them, just in terms of, you know, the energy that they put into their show. It sounds like they really care about their audience. And I'm saying this from seeing a lot of different shows, and I've seen shows where a lot of times a band doesn't care. They just want to play, you know, get on to their next show. They're tired, you know, they might be whatever. But I felt like, you know, when you see them live, it kind of changes your perception. And my wife really didn't like them. She thought it was too long, it was boring, it was too dark. And when she saw them, she was instantly sold on the band. She really loves the band. She listens to the album repeatedly. So I don't know if it's the whole thing about the difference between people who have seen them live and the people who haven't seen them live. And I'd be interested in what, you know, your guests on the line think about that.
All right, Chris, I'm clearly you've seen them live.
I have seen them live, although I missed their show at Meriwether Post Pavilion, which was the day after the Madison Square Garden shows, because I was at a Gucci Man show. Sorry. So, priorities.
And man enough to admit it.
I didn't know when I'd get a chance to see Gucci again, but I was pretty sure Arcade Fire would continue touring relentlessly for the next couple of years. So, but yes, I think live, I mean, it's hard to give a band a hard time in saying, you know, they put too much effort into their live show. That's great. I think everyone loves to see a group sweat. But again, the product at the end of the day isn't enough for me. And this is exactly, you know, the problem. All these people are flocking to this band because they love to see this really kinetic display of energy, you know, this earnest passion. But the songs that are underneath it, the soundtrack to it, is just weak and unimaginative, you know?
All right. Christopher joining us on the line from Kent, New York. Do you agree with Chris?
Yes, I do. I agree with my namesake. I have this impression that if you took the Sgt. Pepper's album and slammed it together with both of the albums from David Bowie's Tin Machine, Oy Vey Baby and Baby Universe, you'd get a sound a lot like Arcade Fire.
That's, well,
interesting.
You know, I mean, since David Bowie, as has been mentioned before, was an early adopter and an early fan of Arcade Fire. And they've actually sung at least one of Bowie's songs.
Oh, yeah. And I think they've palled around, especially in the early days. There was that association there.
So, all right. So Beatles plus Bowie equals Arcade Fire. What about something that I mentioned in today's blog, which was, you know, some people, Chris, are really annoyed at how Arcade Fire got to be number one, as if, you know, again, to blame Arcade Fire for Amazon's pricing policy, which was basically to treat their album like a loss leader, just to get people into the door, so to speak.
Exactly. I'm not angry about that. I don't have any kind of, you know, indie rock credibility issues with it, or in terms of their integrity being compromised by doing this pricing. But I do think it is a very well-concerted effort by the band to broadcast this notion that we are the most important young force in rock and roll. You know, we're going to have a number one album. We're going to make sure that that happens. We're going to play two shows at Madison Square Garden and do this fantastic, webcast to kick it off and get the energy going. And I think they really have manicured their whole situation to, you know, really present themselves as something important with the capital I. And to me, just be important, you know? Like, The Clash was just important. Fugazi was just important by the energy and the ideas that they put forth. It seems Arcade Fire just seems like they're putting a really, you know, ornate frame around a really boring picture. And it just comes back to the songs over and over again. I mean, how they're presenting it and how they're doing it is fine. But the fact that they can, all these influences that all, you know, the callers have called in today and all the influences that we've talked about, they're all there for sure. But I think they're just watered down to, like, the, you know, the least, just turns into nothing, and it just becomes this flavorless mix that does not connect with me, and it's frustrating. I want to be on the team, guys. I want to love it, just like y'all, but I'm not there.
I think it really depends on what sort of time you want to give some of the. I mean, okay. Here's the thing. The record has a lot of really energetic, wonderful, blustery, in a good way, songs on it. It also has some really muted, somber songs. And to my mind, if I'm 100% honest, there's a couple of songs towards the end where I feel like the energy really sags. But, you know, the way that I engage with that record is, you know, I'm going to savor it and really try and get into the nooks and crannies and you know, and let it wash over me a little bit and really enjoy those subtleties. You know, there's moments, that whole, the kind of retracing your childhood thing, it's like putting a seashell to your ear and listening to the sea, and that's a subtle thing to do, and that's not watching The Clash or watching Fugazi. That's like a very small way to engage with something. And this record, to me, reminds me of Björk's Vespertine. You know, Björk had made all these enormous, almost pompous, if you like, sounding, but imaginative, whatever. She made these big records, and then she made a tiny little record with what she called micro beats on it, exploring really the more subtle aspects of herself and her relationships. And a ton of people hated Vespertine, but for me, it's my favorite Björk album, and I relate to those same aspects with The Suburbs.
And, you know, a lot less of the big beats and a lot more of the harps and things like that in Vespertine. So there certainly are some unusual sounds on you know, Arcade Fire records, just purely the size of the band. And let's go back into the control room. Joel Meyer has a few final thoughts from some of our Soundcheck listeners who want to weigh in. Joel?
John, if I were to characterize the sentiment on the Soundcheck page today, it's mostly negative comments, mostly anti-arcade anti-arcade fire comments. Like Frank.
Come to D.C., I'll buy you a drink. Come on down.
Well, maybe Frank from New Jersey might not be too far away. He could make the drive. Here's what he had to say. This is bad 80s new wave redone. We survived this once. I hope we can survive it again. Nothing new and unique. Frank, kids just don't know better. That's quite stoic, Frank. Also, our listener Pauly from New York calls out a specific song on the new album, The Suburbs. Pauly writes, "We're all eager to criticize heavy-handed art that critics love. While I'm sick of the Springsteen comparisons, this point seems valid. If Sprawl 2, the song Sprawl 2, is condescending, well, so is Born to Run."
Here is a little bit of that song, Sprawl 2, from the album The Suburbs, number one on the charts currently, from the band Arcade Fire, who've been the subject of this week's Soundcheck Smackdown debate. Sophie Harris, music writer for Time Out New York, here with me in the studio. Chris Richards, pop music critic for The Washington Post, with me on the line. Sophie, Chris, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much.
Hey, thanks, John.
Still to come, the New York jazz group Respect Sextet includes funk, rock, and New Orleans-style marches in its repertoire. They'll play live in our studio next on Soundcheck.